The Church of God, the Eternal, presents Seeking God's Will, a message given by Mr. John Brisby, in Eugene, Oregon, October 28th, 2023.
It's been quite a number of weeks ago that I started making some notes to put together the sermon that you're going to get this afternoon. And it's because I, in the course of talking with a lot of God's people, counseling for those who ask me opinions for input to help them in making certain of their personal decisions, some of these concepts crystallize in my thinking. And I'll tell you again that what I prepared for you is nothing new or outrageous. It is a resummary of a lot of what I consider common sense basic principles that go along with what we've been taught in God's church. But I hope it's something that will give you some particular help in personal choices that you make. I've entitled this message, Seeking God's Will. Seeking God's Will. Now, you and I are all focused on seeking God's will. You're members of God's church, you're sincere, you want to do everything that you do within the bounds of that which is pleasing in the eyes of God. Okay, does that mean it's easy? Not at all. Because you and I are all faced with choices and situations that require decisions that are not, it's not like having a yellow brick road that you just follow and it tells you exactly where to go. And so very often the people of God are faced with situations and they're not sure what they should do. And in those cases, then we seek God every day, but in special circumstances, we certainly seek his guidance when we're faced with a challenge on a personal decision. What are some of the pitfalls that many of God's people encounter as they make decisions seeking God's help? And how, because there are many times, I'm going to say, significantly enough circumstances historically that makes it relevant, people, sincere members of God's church who end up saying, I asked for God's guidance in making this decision, but it turned out bad. What happened? Why? I wanted to do the right thing, and I asked for God to show me. And I did what I thought was according to his will, but boy, am I sorry. What gives? So that's the gist of what I'm going to try to address today, to give you tools, ammunition, if you will, in your arsenal to try and make better decisions. Avoid the kind of pitfalls that God's people traditionally have run into, and to learn how to deploy wisdom in the course of all that you choose to do. What are the kind of decisions we're talking about? Well, I'm not talking about doctrinal issues. Should I go to the Feast of Tabernacles? Well, yeah, you should go to the Feast of Tabernacles. I'm talking about the ones that aren't as apparent maybe that apply to a right or wrong. Where should I live? Should I stay put? Should I move? Should I change jobs? I have another opportunity. Should I take that or should I stay with what I've got? What about the managing of my money? What about investments? I've got a big expense ahead of me because my car broke down. Should I fix the one I've got or should I trade it in and get something else? Or it might be something personal, like dealing with a dispute with someone else, family member, somebody in the world, or somebody in the church. How do I negotiate this and make a good decision? Chart a path that is actually in God's will, not apart from or contradictory to God's will. How do I make these kind of personal decisions? Many decisions, to begin with, actually do not require extra special inspiration from God. Because we got to start with the fundamental ones that have us to look to his law, to his instructions on right and wrong. So yes, we want to get to the ones that aren't an issue of right or wrong, but we've got to start with the basic fundamentals. He's given us his law, which is the starting point. So let's turn to Psalm 119, beginning in verse 95. I'm going to read verses 95 through 105, just to give you the gist of the psalmist who is expressing his orientation in facing his challenges, his trials, his tribulations, and his required decision-making, and what's the fabric of it that he's using as a foundation for all that he does. Psalm 119, beginning in verse 95, the wicked have waited for me to destroy me. So there's some sort of a pressure in the world. There's some kind of a threat on the horizon, whether it's a person or whether it's a circumstance. But I will consider thy testimonies. So the first thing he does when there's something dangerous or threatening that's causing him to have to make some sort of a decision is what? Turning to the testimonies of God. Verse 96, I have seen an end of all perfection, and it's talking about that which is perfect physically in the world. But thy commandment is exceeding broad, meaning he's saying your commands have no limit. The reach of the commandments of God really are universal. Verse 97, oh, how love I thy law. Boy, if you've got that as a foundation in your thinking, I'm telling you, you have the most important ingredient, and it will inform everything else you have to do. Now, if instead the law of God is I believe this, you know, on a technical basis or an intellectual basis, the Bible and the Ten Commandments and but then when it comes down to making your personal decisions, you are kind of very willing to set that aside if it doesn't fit with the way you want things to be. Now that's a different kettle of fish. But here's an individual who begins by saying, oh, how love I thy law. It is my meditation all the day. Thou through thy commandments hast made me wiser than mine enemies. Yes, you see the laws, the instructions of God, the definition of right and wrong, good and evil, is the source of wisdom. It is the source of wisdom. Thou through thy commandments hast made me wiser than mine enemies, for they are ever with me. Verse 99, I have more understanding than all my teachers, for thy testimonies are my meditation. I understand more than the ancients because I keep thy precepts. I wonder how many of us stop to think about that. By virtue of having been called by God and revealed the value of those commandments, statutes, and judgments, and the application of those principles in our daily decision-making, it makes you wiser than anyone who's ever lived on the earth. If we'll use them, if we take them to heart, that is. Verse 101, I have refrained my feet from every evil way. How does he do that? Well, he compares his actions or proposed actions to the litmus test, the yardstick, if you will, which is God's standard for right versus wrong. That I might keep thy word, I have not departed from thy judgments, for thou hast taught me. How sweet are thy words. So this isn't somebody who says, yeah, I know God says this is what is right and this is what is wrong, and we're supposed to do the good and we're not supposed to do the bad. Okay. But I don't like it. This is somebody who has been taught it. It's called the mind is open so that they can understand it, and then has come to value it as the basis for decision making. I have not departed from thy judgments, for thou hast taught me. How sweet are thy words unto my taste, yea, sweeter than honey to my mouth. Through thy precepts I get understanding, therefore I hate every false way. Verse 105, thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. You see, the upshot from that whole passage is found in verse 105. By using that standard and loving that standard of God's law, then you see that law actually becomes the light that allows you to make better decisions personally. Thy word is a lamp unto my feet. Now, nobody needs a lamp, you know, to go, you know, on a dark path or something. If you're just staying at home all the time and you never go anywhere, you don't need the lamp in the same way, do you? So, but this analogy is somebody who's traveling, moving in darkness and needing some kind of illumination so that they don't fall into a trap or a pit or whatever. So it's a light in order to move forward. In other words, to help you make decisions. Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. Someone who's traveling. Someone who's going somewhere who needs some help to know where to go, when to go, and how to go. And so the foundation is this standard of God's law and his precepts and his judgments. So the first test for any decision you or I have to make is it within God's law? And some of you are thinking, yeah, I know. But you might be surprised at how many of God's people, historically and even today, run into serious challenges when making personal decisions because they forget. Something is so enticing to them about wanting to go or do or whatever. And technically, the law of God is kind of an impediment because according to God's precepts, it's not a good choice at all. In fact, it might be one that's dead wrong. But whatever this thing is so enticing, we rationalize it. Well, I know this isn't exactly right, but you know that the greater good of where I will end up if I do this, and then I'm going to try and sort out the rest. That's a losing game. So I would say whatever your enticements or your worries or your fears that drive you to think maybe I need to do something, fix something, accomplish something, if your standard is, number one, is it legal? Is it legal by the laws and the precepts of God? And if it's not, shoot it down. That's your starting position. God will never inspire you to take an action which violates one of his laws. And yet how easy it is for us to pray to God and say, oh God, please show me a solution for this particular problem or this opportunity or whatever this thing is. I need an answer from you. And I've literally had people then tell me they're doing whatever they're going to choose to do, even though it's a direct violation of the law of God, but they're saying that God said it was okay or led them to do it. They claimed his intervention for doing something which is a violation of the principle. Now, a lot of you are saying, I wish that was my only problem because those are typically not my challenges. But I have to start there because we need to say, you know, what should be the 101 material or the basics for some who may yet still have a challenge with that. And in fact, I want to give you an example historically from the 1970s. And it's a personal example of Mr. Herbert Armstrong. Now, I would not read you this material if it was something that was written in secret. But these are things that Mr. Armstrong wrote publicly to the church in the co-worker letters. To make this point, this is from the co-worker letter, April 18, 1977. You understand, 3 years after the change in the doctrine of divorce and remarriage, 1974. And here's what he wrote to the church, quote, since her death, meaning his wife Loma Armstrong, God miraculously has opened to me doors to kings, emperors, presidents, and prime ministers so that Christ's message may be taken into nations whose doors were closed to this message. At this stage, no one but myself can do this, and I could not endure the grueling worldwide travel had not God blessed me with youthful vigor, vitality, and energy, enabling me to carry on more vigorously than one in 100, half my calendar age. This, and he was in his mid-80s at this time, by the way. He goes on and says, this almost constant travel last year, 300 out of 365 days, and loneliness has reawakened me to the serious need God recognized when he said, quote, it is not good that a man should be alone. Of course, he said no one could take the place of my beloved wife of 50 years, but the work of God must go on, finishing the great commission God committed to me in this new and most important phase of the entire work. And I'll stop right there and just make a comment that that, quote, new commission that he endeavored beginning in 1968, within the year after his wife died, is also highly questionable, because he didn't actually do a last final work before the return of God, because Christ did not return in 1975 or 77 or 85 or 95 or 2005 or 2015, which means that work has not been done yet, but he thought that's what he was doing. And so he goes on and says, and God now has graciously provided the wife to be constantly at my side, a woman truly led by God's Holy Spirit. We have given the matter much time to be sure it has grown into true love and like-minded rapport, as well as definitely sure it is God's will. So he made this decision, announced it in 1977 to the entire church, because he sought to know God's will, and married a new wife. He says, this is to announce my marriage to Ramona Martin in an informal and simple ceremony attended only by our respective families on Sunday, April 17th, Garner Tidd Armstrong officiating, unquote. So in 1977, he got married. And he sought God's will to make sure this was what God wanted him to do. Do you believe it was? Well, guess what? If we applied the standard that I just told you about from Psalm 119, the law of God, the answer was no, because Ramona Martin had a living husband and an adult child. She was a divorcee. And according to the standard that Mr. Armstrong had taught us for 40 years up until 1974, she was not eligible to marry anyone, him or otherwise. But see, after they changed the doctrine and got him to sign off on it, and then he came to believe, I guess that that was okay. But he sought God's will. How'd that work out? Well, you don't have to trust me. Let's fast forward 5 years and see what Mr. Armstrong said about that decision. This is from the co-worker letter, April 21, 1982. Literally almost 5 years after the first announcement. Here's what he said, quote, but in my letter to you, April 18, 1977, which I just cited, I said the loneliness had reminded me how God said it is not good that a man should be alone, and I felt God had, after 10 years, provided me with a wife to be constantly at my side and give the help and companionship needed for God's work. But with deepest regret, I have to say to you now, Mrs. Ramona Armstrong has refused to be at my side here in Pasadena headquarters or in further travel, but has insisted on living separately in Tucson. It has been determined by events, facts, and fruits that I am not spiritually bound by God and only by man's law of this world. Circumstances now render it ill-advised that I condone the continuation of the legal marriage, both from the church point of view and of my own. It was my hope and effort to resolve the matter, and with the least publicity possible for the benefit of the church, for her and for myself. All attempts to do so have failed. It has therefore become necessary that I accede to the advice of church legal counsel and file the necessary legal proceedings. I assure you every effort has been made at cost of heavy stress on me personally to avoid this. God hates divorce, he says. So do I, he said. I have gone to every effort to prevent this. It would be inappropriate at this time that I state all the facts, but if necessary and proper later, I will reveal more. This determination should not be used as a precedent to encourage or justify other divorces in the church. That was all in caps, unquote. So the point I want to make is, even the one who we believe God used strongly to establish the true church in the 20th century, in his old age, did very much like other servants of God did And what happened was he got untethered from the foundation of the original faith on the commandment concerning marriage and divorce. So in 1977, he claimed he sought God's will. And he was certain it was within God's will. This was God leading him to do this. 5 years later, he said, not so much. Our answer is, yeah, it was against the law. From its inception, it was a no-go, which is one reason that it failed. So I point that out as a foundation for you and me to learn from. Like all of these examples in the Bible that God chose to record, including the embarrassing situations of many of the patriarchs, like Moses and David and others. I mean, poor old David, guilty of murder and adultery. And he has his dirty laundry written in the Bible. When he's resurrected, I wonder how he'll feel about that. But see, it's for good that we can all learn from it and hopefully avoid those kind of decisions. Again, what I just read to you was public document. It wasn't secret correspondence. So before we even talk about making decisions and seeking God's will in the murky realm that doesn't include right or wrong, let's not forget, fundamentally, use God's standard to determine if what you're considering doing should never even be considered at all. All right, beyond that, then what? What about when it's not an issue of right or wrong? Choice A or choice B or C or whatever you're entertaining or thinking might be needful or might be advantageous, there's no violation of God's law involving in it. It's literally a personal choice, but how are you going to do it? And you ask God, please, God, guide me to make a wise choice and not to be foolish. Those are the ones I really want to get to. And first, my advice to you, don't assume that your answer is going to come hand-delivered by an angel in a special vision or a dream or something like that. I mean, that would be like the yellow brick road, wouldn't it? Oh, here's your path. Just, you don't even have to think about it. Just, it's all laid out for you. Just do this. I don't know about you, but in my life, that's not how God has guided me. For the most part, I have had to be patient and wait for God's subtle guidance. And I think there are reasons that that's the number one means by which he does. Now, if we are doing what is pleasing in his sight, he has promised to be there for us. But I know of very few instances, if any at all, in the Last Day Church, where the substance of that is by sending you a special letter delivered by the hand of an angel to say, here's your action plan. I've not had anything like that. So what's my first piece of advice? God may make you try all the options before leading you to the open door. So I've always compared this to being in a room that's got 10 doors. So I'm going to say it's a round room, not a rubber room, but it's a round room and it's got 10 doors. And 9 of the doors are locked and 1 of them is open. But there's no neon sign over the open door that says, here I am. There's no angel to come and to stand there in the middle of the room with you and say, here's the right one. You've got 10 doors and you have no idea and God's not giving you any special insight. So what do you have to do? You got to go over and you got to try every single one. Your effort. Your effort. You got to try until you find the open door. Now, God has provided an open door. But you have to seek it out, meaning you have to use some initiative, some volition. This is very often what I have found, at least in my own personal experience. It's one thing to sit back and say, oh God, please show me what to do. And then you're sitting and waiting for some miraculous intervention or a vision or a neon sign. that confirms it's God's will. And if you get it, good on you. I've not had any such thing like that thus far. But I have prayed many times for God to help me resolve something, and I don't know what the right decision is. Father, please help me to know. Now, the other thing you better do is you better be sincere about hearing what his answer is, rather than already being sold on some predetermined course. That's the other thing that gets us into trouble. We already know what we want the answer to be. And so we're saying, oh God, please, please show me what to do. But we're like zeroed in on the one that we want for whatever reason. And God's inspiration may be much more subtle. No, I'm not talking about the still subtle voice of Satan. That can be there just as much. But you may have to pay attention, and you may truly have to be open to hear the inspiration of God through the Holy Spirit. It's not going to knock you down. Very likely, it's not going to knock you over. So sitting back to make God act first, very often, is not the way it's going to happen. And I know, because you've got people by nature, we probably typically fall into two kind of camps, either ones who are naturally aggressive or ones who are naturally passive. I'm making this up right now, so don't try to hold me to this. But in general, when you see people make decisions, there are some who are hesitant to make a decision, to do something different than what they've always done, and they'd rather their little world stay exactly the way it is. So those are the ones more likely to want God to hit them with an option and to force them to change. And in some cases, he may force you to change. If he takes away your job or allows you to lose your job, for instance, now you got to do something different. You're going to have to go where the work is. You want to support yourself or your family? You may have no other choice. That may be one way he guides you. But when it comes down to those ones where, you know, I could do this or I could do that, there's some who are more inclined to stay put rather than do something different. There are others who are more inclined to change for change's sake, more aggressive, doing something, going somewhere, making something happen. And guess what? Sometimes God will lead to stay put, to stand still, and sometimes he will guide you to move. So it's not a one-size-fits-all. There is no formula that says your path in order to seek God's will is always to hold back or always to go for something. It might be different depending on the circumstance. But you and I, by conditioning, by DNA or whatever it is, we are more inclined to one or the other by nature. Which means if you get an answer or if God's opening a door for you, you might be hesitant to take it because it might be scary. Or you might want to change and insist that this is God's will, when really he might want you to stay put because you're in a better situation now than if you leap and do something else. There's no one size fits all. Circumstances can be very, very different. So the answer there is don't be rash, but also don't be timid. Well, how does that help me? Well, understand and figure out what you are by nature. Am I inclined to be one who's timid and therefore pass up an opportunity that may be God's will to do something different? Or am I one who is rashly aggressive, which means I may have a tendency to leap when I should just stay put? And then gauge everything before you, recognizing what your natural tendency is carnally. Take that in consideration in the decisions that you make. You know, should I move? Should I up and move someplace totally different? Different state, different country, whatever. Maybe so. Might be God's will. God might bless it if you do. Then again, maybe he won't. So a whole lot of consideration needs to be taken. Regardless, wisdom is needed. Now, if you want to know about wisdom, just read the book of Proverbs. I'm going to highlight a few things. One principle is get advice. I'm not going to turn to it. Proverbs 11:14 and Proverbs 15:22 both speak about the multitude of counselors. In the multitude of counselors, there is safety. Meaning, if you will utilize counsel of others. Now, but here's the pitfall. Who are you going to use as a counselor? I recommend that if you're going to take advice or hear advice and strongly consider the advice from any other human beings, they're ones who are known or have some sort of a track record for wisdom themselves. Because guess what? Everybody has an opinion. Everybody has an opinion. And if you pick unwise people for your counselors, then you can fulfill this technically, this provision in Proverbs, 11:14, and make a horrible decision for yourself. So one of the first things you need to do is decide who you're even going to ask for input. And God, and if they're members of the church, led by God's Holy Spirit, that may be a means by which God actually provides some help for you. Oh, I'd rather have an angel. I would rather it be an angel, because then I'd know for sure, right? But if it comes as advice from another church member, I don't know. And I'm not saying take the advice of somebody who offers it to you. I'm just saying this principle is involved. Don't overlook it. In the multitude of counselors, there is safety. You have more to think about to actually give you maybe things you didn't consider. And it might not change your decision. It might not change what is the best path for whatever it is you're grappling with. But I guarantee you, to get a more well-rounded perspective, hearing some other inputs, especially if it's certain individuals who have a track record of wise choices themselves. There's some of you, and I've said this, and I hope you don't take this personally, one, because I never use any names, but there's some of you I would never take advice from, because you got a horrible track record. I love you to death, and you're the children of God, and you have every hope of being born into the family of God, but you got a pretty poor track record of making personal decisions. So I'm sorry, you would not be on my team. And I hope you don't take that personally. And one of the reasons I'm willing to offer that is because there's not a single one of you who cannot become wise, because by access to the Holy Spirit, it is the source of wisdom. We are all foolish to one degree or another. And God did not by and large call the wise of the world. He called fools. So I hope none of you take that as a slight. Okay. But whether we learn to be wise and come out of our foolishness has everything to do with using aggressively the Holy Spirit in our life to learn to make better choices than maybe we have in the past. But you will forgive me if I want some counselors for myself, choosing the ones that have already shown some fruits on the path of wisdom, as opposed to ones who might have strong opinions, but which don't have a good track record for making decisions. Okay, so that's one piece of information. Another one is, for instance, how do you make a decision when you feel like you need to do something and you're involved in a personal dilemma with somebody else? Oh, and we all have those from time to time. Proverbs 15, verse 1 and 2. Proverbs 15, verse 1 says, a soft answer turns away wrath. So you may find yourself in a tense situation, and you hate being there. Not talking about who prompted it, yourself or somebody else, for why you're in it, but you have an earnest desire to say and do the right thing and avoid saying and doing the wrong thing that would make something worse. How do you make it better and not make it worse? How do you be honest with somebody, but how do you not cause them even more animosity? These are tough. So a soft answer turns away wrath. So the perspective of truly seeking to create peace, that's one great thing to keep in mind. A soft answer turns away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. Forget about the issue of who's right or wrong, or, well, I'm only in this because somebody did that, and da-da-da-da-da, so it's their fault. The challenge for us is to get our own ego out of it and think from the standpoint of how to help this other person. They're the ones with the problem. I can feel like they drug me into this. I didn't ask for it. They should just, you know, go their way. Okay, but as a servant, if you're going to help, not harm, if you do anything, how can you make sure what you do is positive and doesn't even throw gasoline on the fire? Because sometimes that can happen. Okay? Takes wisdom. Verse 2 says, the tongue of the wise uses knowledge aright. So again, we go back to the foundation of God's law and the principles and how we choose to answer or handle our own demeanor in dealing with somebody to resolve a problem. But the mouth of fools pours out foolishness. All right, then let's complicate it. Proverb 26, verse 4 and 5. I think we've covered this in Bible studies before. Proverb 26, verse 4 and 5 seems to be an absolute contradiction between these two verses. Verse 4 says, answer not a fool according to his folly, lest thou also be like unto him. Okay, end of story, right? No. Verse 5 says, answer a fool according to his folly. Wait a minute. Verse 4 said, answer not a fool according to his folly. And then verse 5 said, answer a fool according to his folly. Well, which is it? It's one or the other, right? No. Both of these principles are the inspired word of God. So how do we reconcile this? Verse 4 is saying, answer not a fool according to his folly, lest thou also be like unto him. Don't get in the mud with somebody who's just trying to pick a fight for a fight's sake. But verse 5 is talking about a different scenario. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own conceit. What is the clarification? That indicates a guide for when you and I open our mouth to say something to somebody who God is saying they're a fool. And we're not talking about somebody from the classic Greek definition of a fool, which is somebody who is hopeless, basically is headed to the lake of fire. Somebody who is acting, speaking foolishly, which can be any one of us at any time. And if you know them and if you're involved in some way with some dynamic environment and you want to know what is God's will for me, that's what this is all about. How to know what is God's will? Well, I can just always shut up and keep my mouth shut. And I can't go wrong, right? Well, verse 5 says, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own conceit. There are circumstances when the right thing to do is to open your mouth and to reply to someone who is speaking foolishly. And there's other cases where wisdom says, bite your tongue and keep your mouth shut and don't reply. How are you going to know the difference? Where's the yellow brick road in that case? You have to read the circumstance and you have to ask God to guide you to recognize to the extent that you can the dynamic that is involved. But I would tell you, at least from my experience, I don't always know. Sometimes I open my mouth and I give advice or I reply to something somebody says. And I don't know if they're going to take it well or if they're going to turn around and lambast me. And if I want to just be selfish, I can just keep my mouth closed all the time. But yes, that's what it would be. It would be selfish. If I care about them, and if their orientation is they're misguided at the moment, fundamentally they want to do the right thing. They've just been kind of absorbed by some emotional situation or whatever. Then it might be worth it to me to reply if I have a wise principle to impart as a friend and somebody who loves them and cares about them that might help. Now, they still might turn around and bite my head off. So don't open your mouth unless you're prepared for the potential that might be the response, and then you be willing to take it and not make things worse. But at least you tried. There's other cases. Now, if somebody's just trying to pick a fight, they have no interest in what is right. They're intentionally trying to goad you. And you trying to reason with them according to the truth of God or whatever else is going to be like a water off a duck's back. That's a situation like verse 4. Don't rise to the bait. Keep your mouth shut in that case, because you are not going to help them. And all you're going to do is get down in the mud. Walk away from that. But if it's a different situation, or it's possibly a different situation, and you're not sure, and you're the one who has a close personal relationship with them, that means you might be the one in a position to help them, then maybe as a point of service, you would choose to reply. And then be very careful how you do it. This is all under the umbrella of wisdom. But as you can tell, the right path might be very, very different depending on the circumstance. And God allows these things to occur and allows the future to be fuzzy so that we don't know. I'm telling you, by learning to make choices in difficult circumstances where it's blurry and dark and you can't tell for certain, but you can become wiser if you're learning to actually do this better than you used to do before. And me too. So understanding the motivation or the potential motivation of this foolish person at the moment can guide you to know whether you should or should not engage with them. It requires good judgment. So wisdom and judgment, again, are things that come from God. There would be no need for wisdom or judgment if it was always clear, black and white, on what an action should be to be right. No need for judgment. The reason the ancient Israel had judges was because they had the law, but there were still individual circumstances that became fuzzy in how to apply the law. That's why you have to have a judge. That's why you and I must judge in control of yourself and me and in control of myself. Don't judge someone else, but you make judgments all the time in that which is your personal realm. And there's a good way to do it, and there's a very bad way to do it. All right, what's another one where wisdom comes into play? 2 Corinthians 6:14. 2 Corinthians 6, verse 14 says, "Be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers." Okay, well, what does that apply to? We've always applied it to marriage. It goes beyond that. It is a fundamental principle and a way of thinking. So forget about it just in terms of marriage. The reason marriage is definitely involved in it is because if religion is important to you, if religion is super, super, super important to you, in making a decision about who you're going to marry, if you're going to marry, you should pick somebody who shares that. Now, we always default and just say you should never marry outside the church. That's because you're in the church. But if you were a Catholic, I would tell you, if you're a devout Catholic and you go to Mass every Sunday and twice during the week, I would advise you to marry someone who shares your religion. All your marriage counselors will tell you the same thing. You should find somebody who shares some of your interests. You should have things in common. So that's all this is saying. Don't bind yourself together with people who don't really share the things that are most important to you. This is like common sense. It's just not common. Okay, so yes, it applies to marriage. If marriage is important to you and your religion is important to you, it also can apply to business. But wait a minute, we're also told don't get involved in business with church members. Why? Because the history of that has been really bad. But wait a minute, it says don't be yoked with people in the world. So there's only people in the world or there's people in the church. Like, do I not engage in any kind of business contracts, partnerships, whatever? Because I'm not supposed to do it with people who don't share my beliefs, but then I'm also discouraged from entering into business arrangements with people in the church. So what gives? It takes judgment. It was highly discouraged from entering into business arrangements with other church members because there is a tendency for church members to have a higher expectation of other church members. I'm going into business with you, and I have a higher expectation of the way you will behave than somebody in the world. Because after all, you're supposed to be a true Christian. And so then all of a sudden, we start putting obligations that are not contractual. So, danger, danger. Now, I'm not going to tell you don't ever do it. This is not an issue of right or wrong in that case. And I'm not saying don't have business arrangements with people in the world. But you better be very, very judicious in how you choose. On what basis do they have the kind of character that is honest and trustworthy that you even want to, you know, do a joint venture of some kind with? It puts you at risk. So you need to understand, if you link yourself business-wise or marriage or whatever, you are putting yourself at risk with the decisions that someone else is making. You're not in control of that. It doesn't matter that they made a promise. It doesn't matter that you got a contract. You link yourself with anyone, in or out of the church, you now are vulnerable to whether that person fulfills their obligations or not, and you don't control it. By comparison, the more you're in control with yourself, at least you stand or fall based upon your good decisions, not in conjunction with somebody else having to do something to make the adventure successful. So all of those things should be taken in consideration. All right, so wisdom, it's a thing. Because it's not all black and white. It's not easy. You can't just write out a formula and say, follow this, and you'll always know exactly what to do in every situation. No, you won't. Judgment and wisdom are required. And then asking God for His help to show you the things you can't see, but you must be open to it, and you must be grounded in, one, using His law as the first foundation of it, and then using His principles of wisdom in the book of Proverbs as your secondary level, and then seek to hear how He will guide you, hopefully to make good choices and avoid bad choices. But the best that you and I do, we will make bad choices. We will make choices that we regret. But learning from those is also a part of the growth, and God may allow you to do it. So again, we're going back to this question. I asked for God's guidance, and I thought I was following what He led me to do, and it turned out bad. What gives? And it could be because there was a faulty rationalization in there, and on further inspection, you might actually learn something from that experience, which is going to make you stronger going forward. So the answer in the back of the book, don't ever get mad at God, as if He let you down or sent you down a dead-end path. Always, you and I have to look for our responsibility and our opportunity to grow in our ability to apply godly principles, wise principles, judgment. The proof of God's will being involved in something, number one, is going to be, was it legal according to the law? And number two, what were the results? What were the results? So the example I gave you of Mr. Armstrong's second marriage, what were the results? Well, he told us, 1982, that didn't work out very well. So he never addressed in that 1982 co-worker letter whether he really still believed it was God's will in 1977. I think what he did write tells us he didn't think it was God's will. But I wonder how much reflection was there. How much reflection is there for you and me when something doesn't turn out right and we wished it had been different? Matthew 7, verse 16. Here's the principle, Matthew 7:16, you shall know them by their fruits. So God does not give you, God does not give me the ability to read hearts and minds of anyone else. We have a hard enough time even reading ourselves. You shall know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes of thorns or figs of thistles? Even so, every good tree brings forth good fruit. A corrupt tree brings forth evil fruit. A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit. Neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. Every tree that brings not forth good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. Verse 20, wherefore by their fruits you shall know them. The context of this in particular is evaluating men claiming to be the servants of God, telling you the truth in the name of Jesus Christ. But it applies on a broader scale than that. So the end result of many of our personal decisions will be borne out, whether it was wise or whether it was foolish. Did it turn out well or did it not? And there's lessons in the successes as well as the failures. But the worst of all, the individual who's really a fool, is the one who never learns from his or her mistakes. You keep making the same, you keep using the same faulty rationalization for making your choices, and it always continues to turn out bad, and you think doing the same thing next time is going to get you a better result. That's also a definition of insanity, by the way. We'll call it foolishness. Galatians 6, verse 4. Look at the fruits of the things, the choices you have made, the things you have done, let alone what you were able to see in the lives of others. I'm not saying for the purpose of passing judgment or pointing your finger or criticizing or looking down your nose at someone, but you can learn from the examples of what other people did. Even though you love them and you care for them and you will do everything to help them, but you can still say privately, let that be a lesson to me. We can learn good and bad from the ones close to us and choices that they make, and incorporate that into the way we make our own choices, if we're wise. Galatians 6, verse 4, let every man prove his own work. Well, that doesn't sound very Christian. Christians are supposed to be giving. This seems to be pretty like silo-like. Like I'm doing my work and you're doing yours and never the twain shall meet. No, he's expressing what God is really talking about. In the final analysis, you make your choices, and I make my choices, and you find out whether yours were, and I find out whether mine were. Let every man prove his own work, and then shall he have rejoicing in himself alone and not in another. It's basically saying if you manage your life physically and spiritually according to wisdom, you will be the beneficiary of it. Now, others may also benefit from your good choices by extension, but primarily, you control you. I control me. I have to make my choices with everything that I know that God requires of me and everything else that I see, and you have to make yours. And if you do a good job of making personal choices, you're the beneficiary of it. Somebody else doesn't steal the good that comes along from your wise choices. You are the primary beneficiary of good choices. Let every man prove his own work, and then shall he have rejoicing in himself and not in another. You're not depending upon someone else. You're not riding on someone else's coattails to have things turn out well. You're in the driver's seat. For what God has given you as your personal realm, your domain, and accountability. And based upon how you make your personal choices, you are the one who gets a chance to be the beneficiary first. Verse 5, for every man shall bear his own burden. Yeah, we're all going to be judged according to God. As individuals, let him that is taught in the word communicate unto him that teaches in all good things. Be not deceived, verse 7. God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap. So if you're not happy with the results you've been getting, again, don't blame God. Go back to the drawing board and say, how could I have done something different if I don't like what happened? What might I have consider differently than what I did. Whatever a man sows, that also shall he reap, which is another way of saying you will know them by the fruits, yourself as well as what you can see afar and what other people might do and the results that they get. We all make boneheaded decisions. We do. We can do this, but because we're still carnal, we're still human, and God gives us rope, and we will make mistakes. Now, the fewer mistakes we make, the less suffering we're going to endure. The question is, again, can we learn from the mistakes we do make? And now add that to our wealth of experience that informs the decisions we're going to make in the future. Proverbs 19, verse 20. Proverbs 19, verse 20. Hear counsel and receive instruction, that thou mayest be wise in thy latter end. The end result of your life will be one that learned and grew over time. You use the experiences, good and bad, that you encounter, and you absorb that and use that like a tool, which in your later years, if you live to be old, will make you a wise individual. Someone, by the way, who might have a lot to offer others. Verse 21, there are many devices in a man's heart. There are many devices in a man's heart. Nevertheless, the counsel of the eternal, that shall stand. What are these devices? Impulses, thoughts, drives, covetousness, lust, you know, even good things that aren't illegal in the laws of God, but things that may not be good for us. We have all kind of impulses that make us want this or that. Those are the devices that tempt us, if you will, or draw us to want to go one path or another. Nevertheless, the counsel of the eternal, that shall stand. Wherever the will of God really lies, it is the path you want. And I wish he would make it like the neon sign or the yellow brick road so that we can't miss it. But again, part of our learning and growth in learning to apply the law of God into our personal decisions means he's going to make you and he's going to make me judge and weigh and try. With effort, you are going to learn to apply the law of God and become wise. Proverb 9, verse 8. Here is one that confirms this idea. Are you a wise person? Are you open to being a wise person? Here's what God says about that. Reprove not a scorner. That's someone who thinks they already have everything they need and they don't need any counsel from anyone else and they've got the world by the tail. And if you deign to give them a piece of advice, and it's not what they already want, they're not going to hear it. They're going to scorn your input. Reprove not a scorner, lest he hate thee. That goes hand in hand with the one I gave you earlier about a time when somebody who's behaving foolishly, keep your mouth shut because you can only make it worse. Reprove not a scorner. Their mind is closed. They already know. They're on a rocket ride to what they want to do, the way they want to do it. Okay, back up and let them go. Reprove not a scorner, lest he hate thee. Yeah, they'll just turn. If you don't agree with them, they are caught up in emotionally in whatever they're doing. And if you don't agree with them, oh, wow, you're going to get it. God calls that a scorner. Lest he hate thee. Now, by contrast, rebuke a wise man. Now, wait a minute. Why would a wise person need to be rebuked? If the person is wise, then they do things right and they don't do things wrong, which means they should never need to be rebuked. Well, what gives? You're talking about somebody who may not always make the right decision, but they have an overall orientation grounded in the truth of God, desirous of doing the right thing and being open to being corrected like King David was. David was called a man after God's own heart, not because he avoided mistakes, but because he took correction when he made a mistake. And God highly valued that, which is why he set him up then for our recognition. Rebuke a wise man, and he will love you. You see, if I get caught in a poor judgment and it turns out bad, and you're able to show me what I missed, and maybe you'll be the tool, or vice versa. And I learn from that rather than just, oh, wow, you're saying something I don't want to be true, and my ego's caught up in it, so you're dead to me. That makes me a fool, a scorner. But if I can acknowledge when things not turning out the way I hoped they would, something's not quite right. And if someone who is wise helps me see something I didn't see, I'm going to be stronger and better off. Verse 9, give instruction to a wise man. Yeah, wise people even need instruction. They need input in the multitude of counselors. And give instruction to a wise man, and he will be yet wiser. What a concept. Teach a just man, and he will increase in learning. Verse 10, the fear of the eternal is the beginning of wisdom. Bingo. Again, it takes us right back to where we started. The called of God who have the truth open to them are the ones who orient their lives according to those principles of right and wrong, according to God's standard. And then everything emerges from that. And if you're really doing that, you see, you're the one who's going to become wise. You're not going to be problem-free. You're not going to avoid making mistakes. But when you make a boneheaded decision that turns out poor, being wise in your fundamental orientation, you're going to learn from it, and now you're going to let that inform the decisions you make in the future. That's what God's after. But it also explains why he's not going to show you everything. He's going to make you go through the process and discover it. And he's promised to help you. He's promised to guide you. He's promised to take care of you and to shield you from your enemies, to guide you on the path, and to open the doors. But you participate in that process. You're not just going along for the ride. You participate by all these principles we've been talking about. The fear of the eternal is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the holy is understanding. Verse 11, for by me, God says, thy day shall be multiplied, and the years of thy life shall be increased. If thou be wise, thou shalt be wise for thyself. Just already what we read in Galatians. Prove your own works. You're in charge of it. If thou be wise, thou shalt be wise for thyself. But if thou scorneth, thou alone shalt bear it. I like the New Living Translation for verse 12, which says, if you become wise, you will be the one to benefit. If you scorn wisdom, you will be the one to suffer. You see, it's in your hand. God made it available to you. And you, every single one of you, can do this. So if a decision turns out bad, don't blame God. It's part of the training program. Like, I married in the church, and the marriage still went bad. Yeah. The reason the Apostle Paul, you know, people think the Apostle Paul was against marriage. No, he wasn't. But he said because of the circumstances, you know, better not to marry. No, he wasn't against marriage. He was just pointing out a fact that when you choose to marry, for example, you put yourself in a relationship now, you bind your future with someone else, and you can only control yourself. You cannot control that other person. So you are taking a risk. So if you take a calculated risk, that's fine. Just understand what you're doing. You're putting yourself at risk. And if it goes wrong because maybe it's your fault, maybe it's their fault, whatever, learn from it and go forward. Your most important responsibility is to put on the mind of Jesus Christ toward your birth into the God family. Never forget that's what this is all about. Beware seeking to convince others that you know God's will and demand their affirmation of your choice. This can happen when we get emotionally caught up in thinking something that we want or are pursuing is supported by God. You know what? And if you believe God is leading you and inspiring you to know He has something in mind for you and you should go on this path, then again, as we've already seen, then do it. But don't try to force others to support you emotionally in order for you to feel better about your choice. I can't know if God's guiding you or not. You're claiming to have a divine intervention through your prayers or whatever, and then you want me to say, I agree that God is guiding you, but it's a thing I don't know. But then you're going to turn on me as if I'm not being a good friend because I can't know and won't tell you that I'm sure that you're right. That whole thing is whacked. Don't do it. Take responsibility for your choices, and if it's right and if God is guiding you, then go for it. Do not expect me to pat you on the back and give you, approval. I can't know. And God didn't inspire me with that piece of information. Don't fall into that trap. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 5. Ecclesiastes 7, 5 says, it's better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. What's the song of fools? People who tell you, surround yourself with people who tell you what you want to hear, it makes you feel better about your choices. But it's not God's wisdom at all. It's bad advice. So be very aware of the potential for any of us emotionally to desire something which may not be God's will at all, and yet to get caught up into thinking if we can get others to tell us we're right, then it gives us confidence to go forward. That still won't make it God's will, and it still won't turn out right. You will know them by the fruits. When it comes to marriage, I think of an example years ago. In the church, there was a certain man who was pursuing a certain available lady, and he was aggressively going after as a suitor, and in essence, letting all the other eligible men in the church know, hands off, she's mine. And there was another individual who I perceived had an interest in that lady, but was being respectful of the one who aggressively was keeping everyone else at bay. And it wasn't my business, but I had an opportunity. And so I took my own life in my hands at one point, and I said to this other gentleman, all's fair in love and war. If she doesn't have a ring on her finger, she's not spoken for, all's fair in love and war. So I try very hard not to give unsolicited advice. That was one where I did. I'm not saying it made a difference. But all I can tell you is that those two are the ones who married, not the one who was initially being an aggressive and asserting that he had the right or the prerogative. That wasn't God's will, because that's not what happened, and that didn't turn out to be the blessing that the right one did. So don't let what people say. We're not talking about right or wrong in God's law. We're talking about perceptions in people's mind, and they go forward to try and achieve something. Let them go. But weigh all of these things as you make your own decisions. And when it comes, to love, marriage, and dating, all of that, if you can be single, you're safer, because then you only have to control yourself. But God also said, be fruitful and multiply. So the principle of marriage and his whole salvation plan is designed around marriage. So that absolutely applies. And if you're willing to take the risk and you have an interest and there's one, who is a potential mate for you, you're not going to know unless you pursue it. And as for God's guidance, and I think he'll show you, if you're looking at all the right things rather than just the emotional things. So a lot of choices, a lot of risks that are involved. And every single one of them, you can learn, you can grow, and you can put on more of the mind of Jesus Christ that prepares you for your ultimate role as a king and a priest in the family of God, if you're serious and you know the right way to seek God's will.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented Seeking God's Will, a message given by Mr. John Brisby in Eugene, Oregon, October 28th, 2023.